This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. In yesterday's Washington Post, budget director-designate Alice Rivlin revealed that in the 70s, she was part of the Smart Women's Club, a small group of high-powered Washington women who met regularly for dinner to talk about policy issues. This kind of informal women's network is becoming more common in Washington as women try to chip away at the old boys' club that's ruled the Capitol since its beginning. One of these women is Patricia O'Brien. She was a journalist for 20 years, worked as Michael Dukakis's press secretary during the 1988 presidential campaign, and then turned to fiction. Her first novel was The Candidate's Wife. Her new book, The Ladies' Lunch, is about a group of five Washington women who meet every month for lunch and gossip. When the novel opens, one of the women in the group has just mysteriously drowned in the Potomac River. O'Brien told me that she's been part of a ladies' lunch for many years, and it's one of the best parts of living in Washington.
I think that about 10, 15 years ago, certainly among the women I know, we realized that there was something missing as we were all working very hard to succeed professionally, and that was that sense of actually being able to relax with women. And women who do enjoy the company of women are finding that to meet on a regular basis, you, without even realizing it, you are both having the nurturance of personal friendship, and also you are having the kind of classic networking opportunities that it used to be only men had.
So you're part of an official ladies' lunch?
Yeah, I am. Mm-hmm.
Who's in your group?
Well, Leslie Stahl formed our group about 15 or 16 years ago, 1978 actually. And there were just a few of us in the original group. And let's see, they included Nancy Dutton, who is a lawyer here in town, and Linda Wertheimer, who certainly your audience probably knows, with all things considered, and Cokie Roberts, and Ann Charnley, and that was our original, and Dottie Lynch. That was our original group, and we just basically wanted a place where you could relax. We were all very busy professionals. I was working as a reporter here in Washington, and we sort of decided initially what we were going to do is not talk about anything serious. We were going to basically gossip and enjoy ourselves and laugh and relax.
And was it hard to not talk about politics?
Well, you know, as the years go on, of course, what we really found that we had was something quite valuable over time because it developed such texture. You know, it wasn't just work and it wasn't just getting together. If you know people over a long period of time, you go through deaths with them, you go through divorces, you go through illness, you go through good times, you find ways to help each other, and you begin realizing that what you've been part of is something extremely special.
Did you have a name for this group? I mean, do you call yourselves the Ladies' Lunch?
We called ourselves the Ladies' Lunch, that's right. I used the title. And I will hasten to say, and it's been vetted by my fellow real-life ladies' lunchers, my book is not at all about the women that are my real-life friends. But I wanted to take the idea of women coming together and getting to know each other over time. And just briefly, in my novel, in The Ladies' Lunch, they all come together and one of this group mysteriously dies, and it becomes the catalyst for them to discover more about themselves and their friendships, and there's an element of mystery in there. So this is a ladies' lunch of very high-powered women who the reader begins to see much of the personal side of them that you don't normally see.
Well, one of the women's husbands, Justin McAbee, is, without giving away too much of the plot, is involved in the story. And the way you describe him, there's a certain phrase that I thought was pretty interesting. You write, he always looked filled with secrets. People try to look that way in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because I think in Washington, a lot of people want to be seen as very important. And importance and power in Washington always has something of an amorphous nature to it. For one thing, it doesn't last. Every group that comes in thinks it's going to, but it doesn't. It seems just written stone, you know, and then come the next election and the voters may decide it isn't. And people who had extremely important positions or felt they were very key players are suddenly, in a sense, out on the street. And for the really good people who come to this town, they never lose sight of that. They never forget that it's their job that's important, not themselves. But it's a town where a lot of games are played. And people who are perceived as having power do, I think, at least some of them on occasion, have a tendency to try to look filled with a great deal of power and, of course, all those secrets that nobody else knows.
So how does someone cash in on that?
You mean in terms of...
If you have this powerful secret.
Power has such cachet in this town, and it's a social ticket. Some of these are things that people have known for years about Washington, but you almost have to walk through the set to realize how true it is. It increases importance, and Washington does tend, with all of what is really important that does happen here, Washington does tend to turn into itself. Mm-hmm. There is a small town sort of incestuous sense here. There aren't that many ways people earn their living in Washington. You're a lawyer. You work for the government. You're a journalist. Well, there you are. You count the people at the bus stops in the morning or going by in the taxi cabs, and that's what they do.
What do you think about the influence that the First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton has had on the atmosphere inside of Washington? And she's certainly much more activist and much more visible, probably the most visible First Lady.
Mm-hmm.
How do you evaluate what effect she's had on that culture?
Well, inside Washington, I think she has drawn some tremendously savage attacks. I happen to be a strong admirer of Hillary Clinton's, and I think she's remaking a role in a fascinating way, which will be interesting to look back on and see how the changes were taking place. But I think she's taken some real hits, and It's fascinating because I think that that the hostile reactions, this town still has trouble with what one might describe as an uppity woman, huh. A woman who doesn't stay in the place that it's been decided that is hers. Here she comes in, First Lady. Now, the First Lady is supposed to be primarily decorative, sort of a moral presence, she can be a metaphor of a lifestyle. She can be all of what Jackie Kennedy represented, which was new life and change in the White House, and beauty and glamour and many good things. But with the exception of Eleanor Roosevelt, who also took huge hits, most of the first ladies since then have pretty much stuck to their roles, and when they haven't, they've been criticized.
You know, it's interesting, and you use the word uppity woman,
uh-huh.
which is a pretty powerful description. And it's curious to me, in a town that is filled with, quote, professional people, I mean, people, lawyers and people that understand and wield a fair amount of power, why a powerful woman is still considered a threat. I don't completely understand that.
Well, you know, I've puzzled and puzzled over that, and I have one way of trying to describe it. I take a look at someone like Hillary Clinton or women who also seem to elicit this resistance. And if you think about it, what she demonstrates or what she seems to represent is an absence of need. And I think that absence of need really throws a lot of people off when it's a woman. When there is a self-containment, it makes people nervous. Certainly in the situation of a woman who would be there as First Lady. So this absence of need, I think, oftentimes is a silent trigger for hostility toward the uppity women of the world.
Well, it also looks as if she's trying to redefine herself as well, and I don't mean to be too trite here, but even her changing hairstyles seems to be a way of her looking for a picture of who she should be as First Lady. Would you agree with that?
I think there is something to that. I think that the sort of shaping and reshaping of image of how do you appear? Yeah, I think there's certainly that aspect of it. I think women have been we have really through our lives had a very strong conscious sense of how our appearance affects how we are viewed and whether or not we are liked or admired. So I think that Hillary Clinton, as well as the rest of us, may have at times difficulty getting rid of that self-conscious. How do they see me?
Right.
How do I look? So that could be certainly behind the changing hairstyles.
Well, speaking of hairstyles, I'm curious, too, about the kind of wardrobe it appears that women who live inside the Beltway wear, whether they're journalists or members of Congress. And I guess I don't have one of these. It's one of these red suits that people seem to have.
You're going to tell us we're frumpy.
No. I'm not even sure it's even frumpy, but it's when there's I guess if I'm watching CNN or something, there's a picture of Congress or there's an important vote or the president is speaking there and the camera pans the members of Congress, the women are all wearing these red suits. Do you know why?
I think that women back 10 years or so ago became very savvy about what got attention. During the Reagan administration is where I think it began. He began calling on women when they were dressed in bright colors. So the reporters who would show up for the press conferences would wear red is probably the best color that shows up in a sea of gray and brown. And so they would wear bright colors.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is Patricia O'Brien, and she's a journalist and the author of several novels. Her latest one is called The Lady's Lunch. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist and novelist Patricia O'Brien is my guest. Her new book is called The Lady's Lunch. Let me just backtrack, if I can. And you were a journalist, a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, and I assume worked at other papers as well. And you were also hired to be Michael Dukakis's press secretary for his 88 presidential campaign. How did you get that job?
I had been covering both Gary Hart and Jerry Ferraro in the 1984 presidential campaign, and during the course of the year, I met John Sasso, who later was campaign manager for Michael Dukakis, and out of the blue in '87, I had a call, and they asked me would I be interested in. My memory of the first line was, "Hello, Pat, how are you? Would you be interested in a career change?" And at that time, I had been a reporter for 20 years, and I was interested in a career change. I was not thinking about going into politics. But when the job was offered and the questions were posed, it was intriguing. I think I will always have one element of what being a journalist is all about, and that's curiosity. And I thought that I'd always wondered what went on the other side.
Well, did you feel that you were going over to the other side?
I felt I was seeing another aspect of the way the whole process of politics and government works in this country. And it was a really valuable experience in seeing both sides of the process, both after having spent time as a reporter and then being on the other side and seeing how difficult it can be to organize and plan a campaign that stays in the going in the direction that you want it to go. And I have a great deal of respect for the people who work very hard in politics, and there are some that I have not much more than contempt for. So it's the range, but the same is true in journalism.
Well, what would you say journalism then, or journalists look like from the other side? And obviously, you were there to shape, I guess, the kind of coverage that you wanted your candidate to have.
I found, actually, on balance, that the reporters and journalists I had respected before I went to work for Michael Dukakis were the same ones that I liked and respected afterward. I did find that there were a number of reporters who essentially didn't believe anything. I'll never forget the first time I was telling a reporter something that the governor had done, and looked up after having given this reporter the information and saw this complete look of disbelief, as if, no, that's not true. And I said, you don't believe me? And there was this very skeptical response, and that was startling. It was so absolutely, fundamentally accurate, and yet I found myself as a representative for a politician. Initially, the sort of the thrust of journalism has become they're all lying first, and then if they work really hard to convince us, we will allow grudgingly that maybe some of them are telling the truth. And I think that's bad for journalism.
Do you think the press gave Michael Dukakis a fair shake?
I think Michael Dukakis, in the long run, was not a man who had wanted enough to be president from the beginning. And he's a terrific person, and I will always respect him. But I think to run for president takes a deep, deep hunger and commitment and focus. And in many ways, and this is a positive thing about him, that was not there. He had his whole life that he was thinking about, and in a sense, things moved on so rapidly. And when he became the nominee, or moved towards, and that when the engine started rolling, it was a surprise to him.
When you were a press secretary for Michael Dukakis during his presidential campaign, I assume that you knew about Kitty Dukakis and her problems with alcohol, did you?
I was called into Kitty's office. Let's see if I can go back. Now I've got to reconstruct. Yes is the short answer. And if you may recall, we had a major release of the information. I had been hearing from some reporters that there had been some period of time before I ever came to Boston Work Forum where Kitty had disappeared off the screen, and they had said she was somewhere, but they didn't believe it. And there were all sorts of rumors going around, and it bothered me. I was in this new job, so I went in to see Mrs. Dukakis, and I said, we had a nice talk getting to know her, and then I said, is there anything I don't know that I should know? And she said, yes. So she told me. And I said, this can't be kept secret. This has to be revealed because it will be found out. This is something that frequently people don't realize when they're in politics. And she agreed with me. So we had a meeting with the governor and John Sasso and eventually worked out the format at which the way it would be done. And so I had them, she appeared with her husband at a morning meeting where she was going to tell the story of her addiction. And this was when she was addicted to pills, as you might recall, and she had gone to Hazleton, the treatment center, and that's where she had mysteriously disappeared to before he ran for president. So while she was giving the speech, I sat in my office with half-hour segments through the entire day and night and called every news operation and said, you're going to want a half hour with Kitty Dukakis today.
Hmm.
And some of them said, nah. but they did. And so that was a major, getting that story out in a major way was very important to me.
Let me ask you about something else that Maggie Stebbins, the journalist in your novel, deals with, or is I guess is grappling with. She says she violated a code in journalism, and I got the feeling that the code that she felt she violated, and this is because she felt so bad about having written something about a senator and then actually had outed him and then he killed himself, And it seemed like the code that she violated had to do with getting emotional about a story. Is that what you meant by the code?
Yes, in that sense, what it really, in a way, becoming too thoughtful about something. There are certain barriers up for reporters. And again, when I am glad to see people begin to challenge them, and they are self-justifying barriers. The job isn't easy. What you are there for is to give people the news, to tell them what is happening, to essentially give them heads up on stuff. It's to let them know what's been done to their money, what's all of the various aspects of what a free press is all about in this country. When there are either ethically or morally ambiguous situations, I think that there is a strong tendency in the whole business of journalism to try to deny the ambiguities. And if you get bogged down in the ambiguities, it makes everybody nervous.
So for journalists then who are trying to deal with some of these ambiguous situations, you're saying what they do is report them as if they are fact when in fact they're not. Is that what you mean?
No. What I mean is, in much of what you do, if you overthink it, I've had an editor once say to me, "Don't deep think this; just do your job."
And by that meaning, don't consider some of these ambiguous situations.
Mm-hmm. It makes for a softer lead.
And were you able to do that?
No, which is why, really, after 20 years, I'd had enough. The business was very good to me and for me, and I had some wonderful experiences, and I'm really glad that I've had that career. But there was a point at which I thought, I really want to go on.
Well, I thank you very much, Patricia O'Brien, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Patricia O'Brien's new novel is called The Lady's Lunch. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.